Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is the discussion portion of last week's Who Protects the Consumer, part of Volume 7 of the 10-part public television series Free to Choose. Milton Friedman is joined by other guests at the University of Chicago to discuss some of the ideas presented in the documentary segment of Who Protects the Consumer. Listen now, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
I agree with Mr. Friedman with respect to those agencies which have had the major purpose of economically propping up a certain industry, which is why consumer advocates like myself advocate the elimination of the ICC, the CAB, the Maritime Commission. But when you're talking about consumer protection in the marketplace, and when you're talking about government watchdogging competition, consumers need, and as every poll is showing, they're demanding more and more protection. And to give just two examples of how information is simply not enough to protect the consumer. 5 years ago, I could not have bought a child's crib in this country that would have had the slats sufficiently close together that I did not have to worry about the child strangling. Not until the government and the Consumer Product Safety Commission stepped in did consumers then have the choice to buy that type of a crib. Strangulation's down 50%. And in 1975, if I had wanted to lease a Xerox machine, I could not have done it. And not until the Federal Trade Commission Antitrust stepped in and forced competition into that marketplace did I have that choice. And in 1 year, the price went from $14,000 down to $5,000. Those are dollars back in our pocketbooks, to say nothing of minimized emotional trauma.
Well, before we ask Milton Friedman to come back on that, let's establish the viewpoint of our other participants and experts. Dr. Richard Landau, what's your reaction?
Well, I think the cost is certainly outrageously large, and the benefits are trivial, if any. I think that perhaps Milton overstates it slightly to make his point, but basically I would have to agree with it in the area that I know best, which is the regulation of new drug development.
And Joan Claybrook?
Well, in the auto safety field, we've saved about 55,000 lives and millions of injuries because of auto safety regulations since the mid-1960s. I might also comment that the cost of auto crashes each year to the American public is $48 billion a year, fairly substantial when you compare it to other things, much less, again, the human trauma.
Bob Crandall.
Well, I think it's impossible to disagree with Milton Friedman on the effects of economic rate regulation of the sort that the railroads and the trucking industry have been through. The intent of that legislation was, of course, to protect the railroads and to protect the trucks, and the same thing is true for maritime regulation. What sustains regulation is sort of a populist theory that somehow, through government, we will redistribute wealth from people who own business firms to consumers. In fact, it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way in economic regulation, and there's very little evidence that it works that way in any kind of regulation. As to whether we get any value from health and safety regulation, I think much of it is too new to know.
Well, now that's where the area I want to start with, because remember that was the first part of his argument, the whole idea of consumer product safety action by the state. Now, Is that so far working? Very close to your interest, I know. What's your reaction, Kathleen O'Reilly?
Well, on product safety, in the state of that, the lawnmower industry had said for 20 years they could not design a safe lawnmower. Only when the Consumer Product Safety Commission forced them with the new standard, suddenly their creative genius was overnight. They came up with net whips that were made out of plastic, and they came up with very innovative forces, which is why that government presence actually triggered innovation that otherwise would have been left uncovered.
It's very easy to see the good results. The bad results, it's very much harder to see. You haven't mentioned the products that aren't there because the extra costs imposed by Consumer Product Safety Commission have prevented them from existing. You haven't mentioned the case of the Tris problem on the flammable garments. Here you had a clear case where the a regulation of the CPSC essentially had the effect of requiring all manufacturers of children's sleepwear to impregnate them with Tris.
Oh, but that's not
3 years, 5 years later, the regulation required the garments to be non-flammable, and as it happened, Tris was the most readily available chemical which could do it.
Kathleen O'Reilly?
That's absolutely not true.
Let me finish the story first, because the second half of the story is the important part of it. It turned out that Tris was a carcinogen. And 5 years later, or 3 years later, I'm not sure the exact time, the same agency had to prohibit the use of those sleepwear garments, forced them to be disposed of at great cost, to everybody concerned.
All right, let's look at the real interesting history here. 1968, when Congress passed the Flammable Fabric Act, they did not tell the CPSC what chemicals would comply with that and what would not. And so initially when industry said, we're going to use TRIS, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, from their initial test, were disturbed by it and had announced informally to industry that they were not going to allow TRIS to be used. Industry balked and said, we're going to take you to court because the act only says it has to be flame retardant. You, the government, cannot tell us how to comply. And it was the industry that forced the hand of CPSC away. And they don't even deny that.
I'm not trying to defend the industry. Go slowly. I am not pro-industry. I am pro-consumer, unlike you. I'm not pro-industry. And of course, industry will do a lot of bad things. The whole question at issue is what mechanism is more effective in protecting the interests of the consumers, the dispersed, widespread forces of the market. Take the case of the flammable fabrics. Suppose you had not had the requirement.
By the way, you believe that it was right to test them, don't you? For a government agency to test them?
No, not at all.
No.
There are private consumer testing agencies. There's the Consumers Research. There's Consumers Union. You speak about a widespread demand for more protection. Those agencies have those organizations.
They have all these publications on cars. So what they do is they test the brakes and steering. They never crash test them. And the most important thing to know about a car when you buy it is if the car crashes, are you going to be killed unnecessarily? So you can't even get that information.
But the reason they don't test them.
It's too expensive. That's the reason why.
Of course. And why is it too expensive for them? Because the number of consumers who are willing to buy their service and take it is very, very small.
That is not why. The reason why is because it's enormously expensive.
Of course, but if they had a large enough number of customers, if there were enough customers, enough consumers...
Yes, but that's a chicken and egg situation, which is ridiculous.
It's not a chicken and egg situation.
If you believe that technological information is important for consumers to have, which is the basis and the thesis of your argument, surely that you would say that one of the things that society does is it groups together to provide basic services to the public, police, traffic services, all sorts of basic kinds of things... the mail service and the fire service and all the rest of it. Why is it that they shouldn't even do testing of technological subjects which the public have no way of knowing?
Before you reply, I want one or two others in on this.
Yeah. It seems to me that Professor Friedman could give a little bit on this ground. Certainly in the dissemination of information is a free rider problem. And one of the problems is that while you and I might value the results from a consumer union rather highly, we don't have to pay for it. We can look over the shoulder of someone else, borrow the magazine from the library, and so forth. I wouldn't go so far as to say that the government should not at all be in the business of generating information, though I am concerned about exactly the same forces, this evil industry that Ms. O'Reilly talks about, having its influence on how this information is prepared. I don't see how we guard ourselves against that.
But
it seems to me that there is a case to be made that the market does not supply enough information.
It may not, but the market supplies a great deal, and there's also a free rider problem in the negative sense on government provision of information, because people who have no use for that information are required to pay for it.
Milton, I don't quite understand your position on this. Are you saying, though, that there's no place for government to test consumer product safety at all?
I am saying, let's separate issues. I am saying there is no place for government to prohibit consumers from buying products, the effect of which will be to harm themselves. There is, of course, a place...
How do they know that effect?
Well, for a moment, I'm trying to separate the issues. There is a place for government to protect third parties. If we go to your automobile case...
What about children? Children aren't choosers.
No.
Right? They don't make choices.
Parents make their choices.
But
let's go...
But if every sleepwear has it, there's no choice.
We can only take one issue at a time. We're a little difficult to take them all at once. Let's take one at a time. I say there is no place for government to require me to do something to protect myself. Now, if government has information...
Obtained?
For a moment, suppose it has information, then it should make that public and available. The next question is, are there circumstances under which it's appropriate for government to collect information? There may be some such circumstances. They have to be considered one at a time. Sometimes there is and sometimes there isn't. But you see, I want to get back. Take your area, Ms. Claybrook. You are now involved on the airbag problem.
That's right.
If I understand the situation, I don't know anything about the technical aspects of it, but the airbag in a car is there to protect me as a driver. It doesn't prevent me from having an accident hurting somebody else because it's only activated by an accident. Right now, why shouldn't I make that decision? Who are you to tell me that I have to spend whatever it is, $200, $300, $400, on that airbag?
Well, we don't tell you that. What we say is that when a car crashes into a brick wall at 30 miles an hour, the front seat occupants have to have automatic protection built into the car.
Why have to? I don't care whether it's an airbag
the reason
or a seatbelt.
Well, there are two reasons why. One is that the sanctity of life is a fairly precious entity in this country.
It's more precious to me than it is to you. Precious to me than to you.
Well, you don't know.
Do you wear your seatbelt?
Sometime I do, and sometime
I see.
Well,
then it couldn't be too precious to you, because if it were, you'd wear it all the time.
I beg your pardon.
Yes.
Other things are precious, too.
Yes. Okay, but wearing your seatbelt is a relatively simple thing to go into.
But now my question is, but I want an answer, a direct answer.
But there is there's a very basic reason why,
yes.
And it's because a person does not know when they buy a car what that car is going to do when it performs in various and sundry different ways. That's number one. Number two, there's a basic minimum standard. It's a performance standard. It's not a requirement that you have certain pieces of products in your cars, but it's a basic performance standard built into your car that when you buy it, no one's going to have less than that, so that you don't have people needlessly injured on the highway, the cost to society, the cost to the individuals, the trauma to their families, and so on. You're suggesting, theoretically, that it's much better to let people go out and kill themselves, even though they really don't know that that's what's going to happen to them when they have that
Excuse
crash.
Excuse me, you're evading the fundamental issue. If you have the information, give it to them. The question is, not a question of giving them the information, the question is, what is your right to force somebody to spend money to protect his own life, not anybody else, but only himself? And the next question I'm going to ask you, do you doubt for a moment that prohibiting alcohol would save far more lives on the highways than an airbag, seat belts, and everything else? And on what grounds are you opposed to prohibition, on grounds of principle or only because you don't think you can get it by the legislature?
I'm opposed to prohibition because I don't think it's going to work. That's the reason I'm opposed
but
to prohibition.
But suppose it could work. I want to get to the principle.
Sure. Yeah.
I want to know, suppose you could believe it would work. Suppose you could believe prohibition could work. Would you be in favor of it?
No. What I am in favor of is building products. I am in favor of building products so that at least they service the public.
I was fascinated by some of the initial comments. Everybody agrees that the old agencies are bad. But the new agencies that we haven't had a chance to...
You're trying to sweep them into your net. No. They didn't agree with that. But anyway,
it was regulatory.
If the basic principle is give me the information, let me choose for myself, if that's the ultimate goal, why is it that in any hearing that you've ever gone to, and I beg anyone to find me an exemption, whether it's airbags or on DES, Saccharin, whatever, you never have the victims of the injury who lost their arm because of a lawnmower standing up and saying, thank God that you gave me the right to become incapacitated. Never do you hear a victim thanking the government for backing off. Never do you hear the victim of an anti-competitive action thanking the Justice Department for not bringing a suit.
Dr. Landau, I promised you could make an observation on that without going into great detail.
Now, when DES was used to preserve pregnancies in women 25 and 30 years ago, there was absolutely zero evidence that it would cause cancer in anybody, certainly not in the children of the women who were pregnant. And for you to say that it is...
ignoring the 1941 studies that showed just that.
There is no 1941 study. This happens to be my area of expertise. I'm an endocrinologist. There was nothing.
Now let's not go any further down that road.
Let me ask Mr. Rod a question. I don't see, if the problem in drugs is that there is a lack of competition, there are a number of drug companies in the United States and around the world, and a lack of innovation, how regulation, which is designed to keep products off the market, that is further restrict the supply of drugs, is going to enhance either competition or innovation. As a matter of fact, everything that I have learned in economics would tell me that that is likely to reduce innovation and reduce competition. And one of the great benefits of drug regulation is that if I'm a pharmaceutical company with an old tried and true drug on the market, I really want the FDA to keep new drugs off the market. It will enhance the market value of that drug. I think that's a lesson that you learn from government regulation, whether it's National Highway Traffic Safety Administration regulation of fuel economy standards, be it drugs, be it pollution controls, their effect is anti-competitive. It's not pro-competitive at all.
If I go on with Bob's point for just a moment, he and I, I'm sure, and all economists would agree that the most effective way to stimulate competition would be to have complete free trade and eliminate tariffs. The most anti-consumer measures on our statute books are restrictions on foreign trade. Has the Consumer Milton? Federation of America testified against tariffs?
We haven't even been asked to.
Now, the Food and Drug Administration, and here, Doctor, I know you're keenly interested in this. What was your reaction to Milton's analysis of where it's fallen down?
Well, I think it's even worse than Milton's analysis or Dr. That's Wardell's analysis of it. If one could look at the past 25 or 30 years of new drug innovation, one could see that most of the drugs that you all would regard as miracle drugs were developed before the Kefauver Amendments.
That's the 1962 amendment, 1962 which ruled
amendments.
What? Now, again, just remind
us. The 1962 amendments, as Milton said, added efficacy to the regulation of safety. Actually, it's what the regulators did with this law that went haywire. I don't see how one can object to the law in itself. What the regulators did was go mad with respect to safety when the only thing that was added to the law was the point of efficacy. After all, the two are intertwined inextricably. For a very hazardous disease like cancer, you will tolerate a very dangerous drug. And for a headache, it's got to be very, very safe. Now, this we've known all the time. But the regulators have gone to the point of utilizing some hysteria over thalidomide and new legislation, which I think was originally designed by Kefauver to get himself to be president by lowering the cost of drugs, to make regulations which are absolutely obstructive. So now, instead of 75% of the new drugs used in this country being developed in this country, less than 25% of them are. They're being developed elsewhere.
Yeah. Now, could we just clarify this point, though? Are you saying there should not be government intervention in the food and drug field of that kind, or is it simply the policy adopted by the FDA or imposed on it by the Kefauver Amendment is where it went wrong?
I believe that certain guidelines are necessary. And it's possible to construct guidelines based upon the Kefauver Amendment, taking the responsibility for decision-making away from the bureaucrats in the Food and Drug Administration. You say, how? I would say by giving it to panels of impartial experts to make this decision.
Now, Milton, do you take that? You buy that?
Nope. I don't buy that.
Now, why not?
Because I have never seen have you ever seen a cat that barked?
Not especially, no.
Well, governmental agencies and governmental laws follow their own laws. Just as the physical laws say that cats don't bark, these laws of social science say that when you start and set up a regulatory agency with power, those powers are going to be used.
I want to move on, though, to the third area that Milton chose, the Interstate Commerce Commission, as an illustration. Now, this is closer to your line of country, Bob. And Ken, what is your reaction first to his analysis, and what do you think needs doing about it?
Well, you're not going to get much dispute from, I don't think, anybody sitting around here as to what the benefits of or costs of rate regulation in transportation are. The only group that you will find now supporting continued regulation there would be the American Trucking Association, and they can't even make a very persuasive case or one that is consistent from one day to the next. There simply is no good reason for continuing this type of regulation. It might continue longer than, say, airline regulation did, because the number of people whose wealth has been enhanced by this regulation, that is, people who drive trucks, people who own licenses to operate, to haul only hardbound books between Peoria and Springfield, Illinois, or something of that sort, those people are very numerous. And it's going to be very hard to do something about it.
But does this prove anything about the nature of government intervention and regulation, or is it simply an example of where the thing was done extremely badly and not in the interest of the public?
I think it proves a great deal about government regulation, and it is no different, I don't think, in the area of health and safety regulation. Let me give you one piece of information about one area of very important health and safety regulation, which I think even Milton Friedman would be in favor of in some form, and that is the regulation of pollution control, or at least the establishment of property rights, so as to somehow reduce pollutant levels from what they would be if we allowed unlimited pollution. In the case of environmental policy, the strongest proponents in the Congress for environmental policy come from the northeastern part of the United States. And the weakest proponents, those with the worst voting record in the Congress, come from the Southwest and from Alaska. You might ask yourself, why is that? And one possible answer, I guess, is that, well, the air is dirty in New York City, but I don't think you'd find many people really worried about the quality of the air in New York City. What they're worried about is their future employment. and the value of their assets in New York City. What would happen in the absence of environmental policy in this country is that more business would move to the Southwest and to the western part of the United States. As a result, Eastern congressmen are very much in favor of a policy which prohibits, through pollution control regulations, prohibits the gravitation. I don't prohibit the form it takes, but they use this as an excuse, just as they will use various excuses, let's say, before the Ms. Claybrook's agency to plump for very tight standards in order to promote the value of their firm.
Well, now, before we go back to ICC, and I want to do that, Milton, what's your reaction to his pollution point? Because I know he's very keenly interested in it.
Well, he and I would agree with his general position that there is a role for government in pollution. I would agree, second, that the present techniques of controlling pollution are terrible. And they are terrible, and they are what they are for precisely the reasons he specifies, because they are an effective way in which you can use the excuse of pollution to serve some very different objectives. That's part of the way in which governments meow, if I may go back to my cat. We've discussed this at greater length in a book that we've written to go along with this program on Free to Choose. The program itself was too short for us to be able to get much in about pollution. Indeed, we really had to skip it because it's such a complicated and difficult subject. But there is a real role for government because that is a case in which you're protecting third parties. And every one of the valid cases, in my opinion, for government entering in has to do with third parties. There's a case for requiring breaks because that's to protect the person you might hit. That's wholly different. There's no case for requiring an airbag, in my opinion. But there is a case for requiring good brakes.
Do you accept that distinction, by the way?
No, because when you're injured because of a failure to use a passive restraint, I'm, in a sense, going to have to help pick up part of your medical bills, part of your insurance rates, because they're spread across.
Absolutely.
And so only on Gilligan's Island, when you have six or nine people not interacting such that all of society is affected, does your distinction have any validity?
The same thing with alcohol. When you're sick from alcoholism, who pays for it?
On the alcohol, the studies have only shown excessive amounts of alcohol to
be
injurious.
I'm not speaking of accident. What about cirrhosis of the liver, my dear? It's a very common
disease.
It's a long and expensive disease.
Could we pause on, Milton's made, though, a very interesting distinction here, that you can damage yourself, you've been saying, or it's up to you if you want to run the risk of damaging yourself. But can you make the distinction?
Let me go back to her question, because she says, no, we mustn't do that, because a fellow who hurts himself is going to go to a government-subsidized hospital.
Not just
hospital.
Government. Oh, but it's more than that. It's all the party's liability as well. Answer that issue with it.
Go slowly. Let me separate the two issues, because I really want to get to this, because your answer is a very favorite one, and there is an element of validity to it. Of course. Well, it's only because we've made two mistakes.
But you don't have to be in a government hospital for it to be valid, because
Hold on for a moment. The problem with your answer is that you're saying one wrong justifies another. I believe that we ought to have much less government intervention into those areas as well. And I am not willing to follow a policy which implies saying that every person goes around with a sign on his back saying property of the U.S. government, do not mutilate, spindle, or bend.
Do you favor the government intervention in those areas where, for example, the bar associations and the eyeglass industry were not allowing their members to advertise? And then the Federal Trade Commission stepped in, and now consumers have the ability to make those kinds of comparisons.
You're getting into another area, but the answer, the brief answer, because we oughtn't to discuss it, is here. I am against those governmental measures which have enabled the organizations to have the power to prevent advertising.
But namely, there were licensure. No government.
Bob Crandall said. Bob Crandall said that in an area like the Interstate Commerce Commission, there is nothing really to be said in defense at all. Does anybody dissent from that, or have we knocked them down flat?
That happens to be the one area on which, so far as I know, you cannot find any dissent anywhere. Even one of the most effective presentations of what was wrong with ICC was done by one of Ralph Nader's groups. Maybe you were associated with that group. That's the thing that really baffles me. Fundamentally, here are people like Ralph Nader and his groups who look at ICC. And what is their solution to the problem? More of the same. A different kind of regulation.
No.
The only problem is that the wrong people were in there regulating.
No, that's not true at all. No, that's a complete
mistake. You work with Nader now.
Yes.
That's Dr. Landau's solution for the medical problem. Let's have the right people doing the regulation.
No, that's a complete misnomer about the difference between ICC and health and safety regulation. There are a number of differences. One involves the economics and the benefits of profits to industry, and the other involves the sanctity of life among
people. Excuse me.
Now, let me finish this point.
Okay.
Yes.
The second one, and it deals with your third-party relationship, is that what you're talking about there is breaks because they're going to affect somebody else. But there are also other third-party effects. For example, if you don't have a helmet used by someone and you hit them with your motorcycle, you're going to have huge damage payments to make because they didn't properly take precautions on the public highways. And the question is, should the public highways be used so that they're going to harm somebody else potentially?
There is nothing that two people do in a world. No man is an island to himself. Everything has third-party issues. But you've got to have a sense of proportion. And the important thing is that government intervention has third-party issues. When government intervenes into these affairs, that harms third parties. It picks my pocket. It reduces my freedom. It restricts many activities around the world.
Is, what are the benefits? And if the benefits in the auto field, for example, are 55,000 deaths saved...
That's a very dubious statistic because, once again, every study has looked at the benefits and not looked at the costs.
Oh, no, that's not true at all. Absolutely not that they haven't
looked
at
the costs. I mean the costs in life. You haven't looked at the fact, for example...
Let me clarify this, Milton. I don't quite follow you. Would you explain what you mean?
Of course. Look, take the automobiles. By making automobiles much more expensive... It makes it more profitable to keep older automobiles on the road. The increased age of the automobile is an anti-safety factor. By making automobiles safer so people can drive them, people drive them faster or more recklessly than they otherwise would, there are more pedestrian deaths.
That's a totally unproven and indeed fully rebutted theory. And in fact, all the savings in lives... there are numerous studies, including from Yale and Cooper from Yale and so on, but the key issue has been shown by the regulation that's been in the last 10 years, you've had a huge saving in life, a decrease in the vehicle deaths that have occurred, the rate of vehicle deaths occurring, and so on.
Let me go back again for a moment. You see, the major effect on the saving of life has been from 55-mile-an-hour
speed. Oh, no, that's not true.
Which is not, after all, in there.
But that is also a regulation.
Primarily as a fuel regulation.
Yeah, that's right. It's a regulation. But your statement's not accurate. The savings in life have not been primarily, they've been very important from 55, but there have been 55,000 deaths saved by vehicle crash safety regulation.
Excuse me. Mm-hmm. There have been 55,000 deaths that you have estimated to have been saved by.
Not me, the General
other
County
estimates,
Office.
Excuse me, other estimates as well, the estimate by Professor Sam Peltzman of this university, a very, very serious study estimated that there were no lives saved if you took into account all of the indirect effects. Now, maybe his study isn't exactly right.
I don't think it is.
I'm not going to try but maybe the other study isn't
either.
We've got to be even-handed.
Some way in between. The words have done well if it's even in between.
I beg your pardon. If people voluntarily want to risk their lives, saying, again, you really would not be in favor of prohibiting hang gliding?
We asked the auto industry.
Far more dangerous. Should you prohibit the 500-mile speedway?
Let me answer that. We asked the auto industry if they would remove all of the safety standards that have been in effect since 1968, and what would be the savings to the public if they did that? And the answer that they came back with was, we couldn't remove those. They expect them now, the laminated windshields that don't crack their head open and the collapsible steering assemblies and the padded dashboards. Well, the public, that is now the societal norm. Regulation has changed the thinking of the public and the understanding of what's possible. And so what you're suggesting is the government regulation is willy-nilly and it produces things the public doesn't want.
You can't take credit for everything that's happened in this area. Four-wheel brakes were introduced before there were safety regulations. Many of these developments would have occurred
for this week. I hope you'll join us again for the next episode.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.